Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of Through the Wealth Lens. I'm your host, Hannes Grascher, private wealth advisor at UBS International, joined by my fellow advisor, Max Grascher. The recent developments in the world of NIL are something we've discussed in depth recently on the show, which makes it even more valuable to be able to welcome on today's guest. We're pleased to introduce Teresa Hudson, partner and labor attorney at Monk Wilson Mandala LLP, to discuss how recent updates in the world of NIL can affect the legal side of NIL for both the schools and collectives and student athletes. As a mother of a former Oklahoma University football player, she brings a unique perspective to the subject. Thank you for being with us today, Teresa.
Thank you for having me on. I'm truly grateful to be here.
Teresa, first off, can you speak a little bit about your experience as the mother of a student athlete at a major D1 football program and how you and your firm started the NIL practice that has now grown into what it is?
Well, I'll break that up into two answers. First, the relationships with a high-performing athlete and their parents or their guardians is one of trust. And, you know, that trust kind of goes both ways. So you don't want to be so overbearing that the child wants to rebel, but also don't be so loosey-goosey that they do whatever they want. You got to provide safe space and place to express their feelings, their thoughts, ideas, and dreams about the future. So what was different about him playing in a Division I football program versus playing in high school? First, he started with, there was no plan B when he was in middle school. He said that playing football was his plan, and he was going to be a pilot. And so, you know, we kind of scoffed at the idea and asked what happens if playing in the NFL doesn't work out. He says, I've got a plan. Fast forward to his freshman year in high school, didn't make the varsity team after he had expressed to us that's what he was going to do as a freshman. 5 games into the season, he was moved up to varsity. And he became the superstar at high school, starting running back for his sophomore, junior, and senior years, and set quite a few records at school. Went on to go to college. Now, this is my 4.9 GPA, 4.7 GPA holding athlete that was a superstar in high school and was called to walk on to the University of Oklahoma without a scholarship, athletic scholarship, that is. Unbeknownst to the school, he had already applied and been accepted into their aviation program and had received a full academic scholarship to the University of Oklahoma. He walked on, and he cherished that time playing football and had an opportunity to be amongst some of the greatest football players in the country and are now some of the players in the current NFL. And so whether he wanted to play football or not, continued in NFL, he wanted to fly. So we fostered that decision for him. Graduated from college, and 2 weeks later started with Southwest Airlines Destination 225. And I'm proud to say he is currently a pilot in the Destination 225 program as a flight instructor here locally. As parents, you know, this success story may be different for you. But ultimately, what you have to do is let your athlete write his or her own story. You can be the ghostwriter in the background, nudging and supporting. But remember, it's their choice, their life, their decision. And sometimes that success has to include failure. Now, I want to switch over to how our firm started the NIL practice group and how it's grown into what it is. Not quite 3 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, senior associates Josie Leinart and Tasha Swarker-Mosier brainstormed after the passage of NCAA's interim NIL policy. And multiple state laws took effect in July of 2021, which allowed student athletes to officially promote, monetize, and benefit from their NIL. And they worked with our firm's global managing partner, Bill Monk, and formed this new practice group called We Are NIL. I joined MWM in late fall of 2022. And shortly after that, we formally launched the We Are NIL practice group. Shameless plug, can be found at www.wernil.com. Now, Josie, who is a former actress and a formidable influencer and wife to former NFL player and college football broadcaster Matt Leinart, has insider knowledge and extensive experience with NIL, public appearances, and is a phenomenal lawyer. Tasha, she's an Olympic bronze gymnast, and she's a testament to hard work and dedication. Her career began as a college athlete at UCLA, and subsequent to performing, to becoming rather, a lawyer, she advocated for her clients through NIL education, through compliance, marketing, and branding. Tasha is now the Associate Athletic Director for NIL at Rice University here in Houston. And the firm expanded its NIL practice group to include lawyers from the firm's corporate practice group department, the intellectual property team, and the labor and employment group. So we all work together providing various services regarding NIL, including training, contract drafting, contract review, trademark, branding basics, policy drafting and review, among other things. And I know that's probably way more information that you were looking for.
I love the background there, Teresa, and how you've used your personal experience to relate to the work you do so often. To dive into some of the specifics of current NIL laws, what are the biggest compliance pitfalls schools and athletes currently face?
Well, that's an easy answer. And in no specific order, you've got state law conflicts, this uneven playing field between schools that have a lot of money, schools that don't, that are competing for the same athletes across the country. You've got financial mismanagement by the athletes that don't have proper guidance for how to manage their money. And then you've got compliance and legal risks. So those are the things that, you know, real world examples can't fully explain thoroughly what those biggest pitfalls that schools and athletes can face currently.
And to shift to the student athletes, you know, they're really the center of this, right? What protections do they currently have when signing with brands or collectives? And, you know, are there red flags that they should particularly watch out for in contracts? And, you know, as an attorney, how can attorneys, agents, and universities work together to ensure that the athletes are educated and protected with the NIL deals they sign?
Right. Well, first, there's representation and contractual issues. So many athletes go into these contracts without legal counsel or experienced representation, which leads to those unfavorable contract terms or, you know, God forbid, exploitation by agents and or brands. Those long-term contracts can conflict with future opportunities. But the biggest thing, the first thing that I would say to those that are, you know, looking at contracting their NIL rights is to get all of these deals in writing, the contract, the agreement, and emails, and make sure that they are included in their specific clear terms about compensation, the deliverables, the duration, termination clauses, and, you know, making sure that the contract doesn't have any pay for play type language or recruiting inducements. Talking to their school's compliance office before signing anything, making sure that they're adhering not just to the NCAA requirements, but also to the state level requirements, and then to their individual school's requirements regarding NIL deals. And those things have to align with the school, the conference, the NCAA policies. In looking at making sure that you don't have conflicts with your current deals, if you will have an NIL deal with one brand or one product, that you're not signing or attempting to sign a deal with their competition so that you're in competition with your current NIL deal. So, you know, work with certified agents or advisors who understand NIL regulations, such as we are NIL. Avoid signing exclusive agreements without a legal review. Always have that available to you. And then be cautious of those unsolicited offers and high pressure tactics. Those always seem to come and catch athletes off guard.
We certainly have seen lawsuits you know, by athletes who were promised things that didn't pan out or weren't delivered. So I think, I think, as we always say, having a team behind these athletes to help them with all these issues is so crucial. Yeah, I want to switch topics a little bit, and we've so far discussed concerns about homegrown student athletes, but there are also a fair amount of international student athletes that attend schools in the States, especially in basketball, right? Are there any emerging NIL opportunities for said international athletes, and what legal hurdles do they face when monetizing abroad?
Yeah, wow. How is international NIL different? Well, it is. So they face additional hurdles because U.S. immigration laws, which place strict limits on how and where they can work, are very crucial. These restrictions kind of affect, not kind of, they do affect their ability to take advantage of NIL opportunities, unlike domestic athletes who don't have these visa restrictions. So international athletes have to consider any NIL deals to ensure compliance with not only what we talked about before, the school, the NCAA, and state level requirements, but also immigration law. So there's got to be this collaboration with the athlete, their school, their compliance department, and legal advisors about how they can participate. Because earning NIL income can sometimes be considered unauthorized employment in the United States under immigration law and could lead to that international athlete either being deported or their visa being revoked. Many college athletes hold international college athletes hold F1 or J1 visas that impose strict restrictions on employment. The F1 visa is the most common that student athletes have, and that limits them to only having on-campus employment or authorized practical training. The J-1 visa has strict work limitations and usually only authorized through very specific programs. So international athletes have to work with their compliance team and their legal team and strategize for leveraging NIL without jeopardizing visa status. They can pursue non-monetary NIL opportunities, such as building a brand presence, while seeking internships or paid positions through authorized channels like OPT or CPT, and considering NIL deals based in their home countries, which then avoids U.S. visa restrictions. So bottom line, international student athletes that are looking for NIL deals cannot work or deliver the product required under that NIL deal while they are in the United States or any U.S. territories. They can only deliver under that NIL deal once they are in their home country or outside of the U.S. or outside of U.S. territories. So there's, you know, strategy, development, planning that must be critically considered for that international athlete.
That's great information, Teresa. And so I want to look ahead to the future a little bit. Are there any major legal battles or precedent-setting cases that could reshape the NIL landscape in the, you know, upcoming few years?
Well, currently, the House settlement was decided back this summer. And within 9 days, there was an appeal filed by female athletes in regards to the media rights distribution, and that appeal is still going on. It hasn't been settled yet. So that's one case that is still ongoing that we will see the results of maybe next year or the year after that. But there will be others that come forward. For example, there are two federal pieces of legislation. One is the SCORE Act and one is the SAFE Act. And I'll share more about that on our We Are NIL social media podcast. But be on the lookout for either one of those federal bills to come and federalize NIL rules, regulations, compliance, responsibilities, et cetera. And they're very, you know, different pieces of legislation that are out there now. And, you know, before they go into existence, we will continue to see NIL being challenged in the court system until there's been some definitive, perhaps even some consistent rules and guidelines across the country regarding NIL. Because right now it's state specific. Each state has different NIL rules. Some of them allow high school students to participate in NIL. and some do not. So you've got to pay close attention to what those regulations are based upon where your university or your college is located and where you're going to school in regards to NIL. Just be on the lookout for those types of rules and regulations that are going to consistently change.
So far we've talked about the student athletes, we've talked about the schools. I wanna move on to collectives and third parties involved in NIL. So what's one point you'd stress to ensure athletes and their families vet legal representation and agents to avoid exploitation in NIL deals?
You know, I just can't reiterate what we said before, is ensure that all of these deals, all of this communication is in writing. Get the contract in front of you, get those agreements in writing, any emails. So any communication that you have with prospective legal counsel or even with agents, get that communication in writing. Make sure that you are holding them accountable and have someone that you trust review that information for you. Now, finding a good attorney to assist you with that review is tantamount to finding a good partner in your endeavors regarding NIL, making sure that those contracts include terms about compensation, their deliverables, what it is you're going to do to receive that NIL money, how long, the duration, and those termination clauses. Again, making sure that there is no pay for play inducement language there. And then talking with your compliance department, because they are also best equipped to help you as a student athlete and as a parent of a student athlete navigate this ever-changing world of NIL, because they are on the forefront of finding out regulations and rules as they currently change. I just think you have to be very careful in reviewing who you are going to get represent you, because at the end of the day, it is your name, your image, your likeness that is being vied for and what you are being paid to support. So make sure that there is someone you trust in doing those reviews for you.
Can we go a little bit deeper into the role third-party collectors play? Can you explain how it works legally and how schools can ensure they're not crossing the line into pay-for-play?
Well, currently under the House settlement, the commission has established that any NIL deals over $600 must be vetted and approved to show that your market value warrants that money at that particular level. Third-party collectives don't have to adhere to that regulation, okay? So pay-for-play occurs when that NIL deal is tied to on-field performance, like so many touchdowns, you get this money, your team wins, you get this amount of money. And it's contingent upon attending a specific school or transferring to a specific school. So it acts as a salary or a stipend to be on that team rather than for legitimate promotional work. And as of July of this year, a U.S. executive order explicitly bans third-party pay-for-play payments in college athletics. And those violations can lead to loss of eligibility, sanctions for the school, federal investigations, or fines, right? So, you know, looking at the actual contract and what it is asking the athlete to do is the best way to look out for crossing that line into pay-for-play. And the NCAA continues to promote NIL deals that prohibit NIL deals that resemble employment or recruiting inducements. And the schools are responsible for ensuring that those NIL deals are independent from athletic performance or enrollment decisions.
Well, there you have it, folks. Teresa Hudson giving us some really crucial legal information to consider when looking into the NIL world. Teresa, we want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your expertise on the subject with our audience. We appreciate everyone tuning in, as usual. Until next time, soak up the information. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode of Through the Wealth Lens.
Mm-hmm. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.